Organic Farming Research Foundation is honored to share this recording of a recent conversation we had with John Bitter, farmer at Frog Song Organics. In the 2022 National Organic Research Agenda report, organic farmers expressed a common concern about the lack of information available for integrated crop and livestock systems. The report also showed that the number one source of information for organic farmers is other farmers. This interview is part of a suite of resources on crop-livestock integration that OFRF created in response to that need. These interviews, farmer profiles, downloadable resources, and more are available for free on our website at ofrf.org. These resources were created with funding support from Organic Valley's Farmers Advocating for Organics program. Keep listening to hear John discuss the challenges and benefits of integrating crops and livestock into his production systems in Hawthorne, Florida. This audio has been edited from a longer, more intimate conversation between John Bitter and OFRF's research and education team. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, I'm John Bitter, the production manager, co-owner of Frog Song Organics. In 2011, we started at this farm, my wife and I as co-owners, and we had both had farming experience previously working for other people's farms. Amy, my wife, actually had a small farm with a few co-owners at least 5 or 6 years before we even started this farm. So she had a little bit of experience of what it was like to have to grow vegetables and sell vegetables. And we did a lot of stuff at the farmers markets before we actually had our own operations. So we kind of knew what the market was. So we set off with about 5 acres of purchased land in 2011. And then it was next to land that we could expand on in the future. So after a few years, we filled out the entire 5 acres. I think it took us 2 seasons, and we filled out all the, you know, plowable land that we could have in that area with the orchards and stuff that we started to at the same time. And we looked to the north, and there was a piece of land over there that was available, and we leased that land from the large landowner. He went with it for a year, and the relationship kind of was going downhill. And ultimately, before it got bad, we were able to basically come to an agreement that he could cut us off a piece of the land. So he was able to break us off a piece that we could finance through FSA and through farm credit. It's like a joint financing. And they were able to offer us a loan on, I think, 57 acres of the adjacent land. And then we took that purchase and put it together with the existing 5 acres. And so now we're up to about 62 acres. Of that land, approximately 20 to 40 acres are in crop production at any given time. And that's just a series of rotations, you know, both vegetable cropping, but we also crop a lot of pastures. We have silviculture for orchards and, of course, the grazing throughout almost the entire farm. There's not many places at the farm that don't get grazed probably once a year. We picked this location because it really is a, you know, central to North Florida and Central Florida. There's a lot of markets we can get to within about 2 hours from here. It's got a good local market in Gainesville, but Gainesville is not big enough of a town and consistent enough of a town to really base a whole operation out of. So we didn't want to do that. And we moved it into the markets of Orlando and St. Augustine and Volusia County, even Tampa now. And so that's where we're selling our produce throughout the week. 4 farmers markets a week, wholesale markets in all those cities I just named, in a CSA program, which is really a lot of like online orders now, not just CSA, like the traditional CSA, but the customized box program, basically our online orders, we call them. We're still trying to push there and find markets and other wholesale customers that work with us well. So now we're just trying to fill in the efficiency of what we're doing. We don't really want to get a lot bigger, but we want to get, you know, more efficient and more profitable.
What is the labor pool on your farm?
Right now, we employ over 30 full-time employees throughout the season, and about half of the team is directly involved with daily crop production. So that's really important, I think, when you're looking at how many acres that we crop versus how many people are directly involved with crop production. And when I was in California, it was 1 person per acre, essentially, when you broke it down, or the better part of a fraction, between 3/4 of a person's work per acre that goes into like growing strawberries or growing vegetables of any sort. It's very intense, especially herb production. I worked in winter herbs like rosemary and thyme, oregano, sage, mint, all the cool season stuff that grew on the Pacific Ocean. And that took at least 1 person per acre. So that's what I knew getting into it. I was like, all right, here's the worst case scenario. It's 1 person per acre. So really, if you look at how many crops a year we get, you know, we're doing at least 100 acres of planted acres a year. And we're able to do that with 15 to 16 people directly involved with it. So that's pretty good for our system and how we're grazing the animals, planting the crops, trying to keep cover crops on it. And I think for the Southeast, you can do something productive in the soil at all times here in the Southeast. There's never a time that it has to be really dry fallow for much more than a few weeks while you're actually plowing it. But throughout the entire season, you have the rainfall, you have the warmth for the most of the year. But in the wintertime too, we grow cover crops throughout the coldest part of the year.
How long have you been certified organic?
We've been certified organic since 2012. It was like the first crops that we actually sold. So, we plowed the ground first in 2011. And then by 2012, we were already certified organic, I think, before we went into the first market. So it wasn't a big deal for us to get set up like that. But I think it got us some customers right out of the gate.
You shared a great graph with us that breaks down the different production and sales shares of your farm. And we will link that on the website from the Frogsong Organics profile page of the Crop Livestock Resources. But can you talk right now a little bit more about your primary production at the farm?
We're a pretty well-rounded farm. But at the end of the day, we're a greens farm. I mean, like out of all of our crops, the greens are, they're the consistent crop throughout the entire year. So we have to be kind of innovative in how we keep producing a lot of greens, because greens are like probably the most competitive part of what we do too. And it's actually pretty surprising how well-rounded it ends up being over the year, especially if, depends on how you break down greens. But even then, there's a lot of diversity in the greens product category. But I think something to think about is how all of this scales and how your pork and how the eggs, they really can't get to be too much of a proportion of this, because it all kind of balances with the rest of it. They could probably triple or quadruple in size of like what we're actually doing right now to make it optimized, but it couldn't go like 10 or 20 times the amount of pork and eggs on that same amount of land that produces the other ones. Something to think about. Like, I think as people are looking at one way or another, like, I'm going to be a pig farmer or I'm going to be a chicken farmer, it's, well, that's 1/8 of what you do or 1/12 of what you do or something like that. And then you kind of build all the rest of it based on what grows really well in your area. What resources do you have already available, rather than trying to bring in too much of the resources that will end up driving you out of business. If you depend too much on other resources, then eventually when the prices of those change, your business model will have to change really rapidly, or else you don't stay in business.
What was your path into integrating crops and livestock? Was there a particular push to begin this practice?
So with animal integration, the primary reason we do it is to turn liability into a resource. And the pigs help us turn over the sweet potato plantings, and they remove the pieces that are left after the harvest. If we don't do that, then the weevil just gets out of control. This area in Florida is actually under like a quarantine for the sweet potato weevil, because it's such a pest in the crop. We do have a pretty gnarly bug here. Here, if you let it fester, it'll ruin all your inventory. It'll ruin all your fields, because a little bug can just like get up and fly about probably a mile or so. It depends on how the wind's blowing, but it's very mobile. And so as sweet potato growers, if we were non-organic, we'd probably just go out and spray Roundup on it and try to kill all the vines that came back up. You could probably do like a soil fumigant too. Those are just things that we don't want to ever take the risk of putting out there. We decided that the pigs are actually the best way to plow over the land without using a lot of diesel. And so the pigs will take, sweet potato scraps and turn it into something that's a very high value product, organic bacon, essentially, but better than organic. It's actually pasture raised and on organic pasture. The amount of grain that we're feeding these animals is like less than 5% of their ration for most of these growing animals. We do increase that ration for like breeders, but in terms of like the pigs that are destined for the butcher, those ones honestly get about 5% or less. Sometimes each week it might only be like 1 or 2% if they're on like perfect pasture over top of sweet potatoes. And then the chickens here too, they're a big part of how we manage the orchards. We'll establish little orchards, we'll maintain orchards. They eat a lot of worms. They eat a lot of curculio, we hope. That's like the worst pest that we have in the area for plums and peaches and nectarines and stuff. Their curculio is probably the worst pest. Millipedes can be a pest I see. They'll crawl up the tree and stuff. So if the chickens are actively just taking out any kind of protein that's down there below the trees, it's going to be like the best case scenario. We kind of concentrate their feeders there around the trees. That definitely keeps the chickens circulating right around the base of the tree and like pecking in there for all the weeds, and they're also obviously putting the manure right there too, and they're scratching it in the soil. So it's even kind of semi-incorporated into the soil. If you think about how perfect it is, it's like, wow, okay. One of the only challenges is just using it with young trees. In the young tree areas, like the small little saplings, like the first year or two, we do like exclude those, or we'll put something around them. So once in a while, the chickens will just decide that they want to eat all the skin off of a young tree, or so all the young bark, you know, the stuff that peels right off. And so that's probably the only big challenge with having the chickens in there. Once the trees are about like 2 or 3 years old, they don't seem to do that, but they do pick on that first year tree once in a while for some reason. We do a lot of cover crops year round to support health, the soil health, and primarily for forage. Both pigs and chickens will eat all these different cover crops that we grow, even sun hemp. As long as it's real small, the pigs will graze it and the chickens will eat it if you mow it down with any kind of mower. We'll mow it down with a zero turn, or we'll mow it down with a usually like a still or some little weed whacker is the best way to mow it down. We're planting throughout November and February with the winter mix. That would be like the 401, Coker Oats, and then wheat if we can get it. That's kind of a year-to-year thing. And then in the summertime, we'll be able to plant buckwheat all the way through every kind of millet. And sorghum Sudan grass has been a decent one to rotate with the millet too. And then sun hemp is a standalone. Most of our cover crops are multi-species mixes, but the sun hemp is the one that really seems to thrive on its own and like block out all the light from the competition. We have crops like sweet potatoes that are pretty much half their job is the forage. They're out there providing like a cover crop throughout half the year, and then the pigs get to graze them down when they're done. We just have that little small window of opportunity where we get in there, turn over the beds, take all the grade A's out of there, and leave all the scraps for the pigs. So for a farmer, we don't even worry that much as long as we're not losing tons of them. But, you know, we might lose 30% of a block of sweet potatoes. That's basically what we'll estimate from all the, you know, rotten ones or damaged ones out there. And it's not real loss because obviously the pigs are going in there and gaining something off of them. So it doesn't hurt as much as if you're just farming sweet potatoes and, you know, you have to go destroy all those potatoes somehow.
Can you give us an example of what a typical rotation looks like for you over a year or a cycle?
This is a typical rotation for us. Is we'll start off with sweet potatoes in the fall and the summer, like fall harvest, and then winter cover crops after the sweet potatoes are harvested. And that'll grow up for a few months, and then we'll graze it down. And underneath that cover crop will be all the sweet potatoes hiding out under there. So the pigs will be grazing basically grass on top and sweet potatoes on the bottom. So that's a really nutritious mix for them. And then after the pigs are done in there, we actually will plow up the ground, form up beds again, and then we'll plant either winter, spring, or summer vegetables, just depending on when the actual grazing terminates. And right now we're in the middle of it. So we have pigs that have started grazing sweet potatoes in October, November. And then when the sweet potato patches get done, we have their dates scheduled at the butcher. We just know that like they have this many more sweet potatoes to go. And then within 1 month, 2 months, 3 months time, we'll get to their end of their cycle when they're done with the feed essentially. And it gets a lot more expensive to feed them once we have all the sweet potatoes out of the ground. So we go to summer cover crops. Then the cover crop grows up, and then the pigs are enjoying the cover crop and the sweet potatoes as they basically plow up the dirt. Chickens too. Let's see. With the chickens, they're under the orchard, and they also use these same warm season cover crops like sorghum. And the chicken fertility is really kicked in over, I think, 4.5 years of managing like this. All of a sudden, after year 5 and 6, then the persimmons start to get like 12 feet tall. It's pretty amazing. We also plant these cover crops between the fruit trees so that we can plan on having the chickens graze them at the right time of the year. And they're basically cleaning up any of the fruit that dropped on the ground, any of the where the worms basically fester, the Herculeo, it's a weevil that gets in there. And if we can control them with the chickens a little bit, it really does help for the next year. We've been battling that pest a lot, but the orchards that get the most chickens and are most isolated from the wilderness are actually the cleanest orchards. We do the same thing in the citrus orchard, millet, Japanese millet to be specific. And we put this in the citrus grove. We'll mow this down. Some of it will go into the citrus trees, and some of it gets fed to the chickens as they graze through here. So the chickens will graze that down. And at the same time, they'll be spending some time under the shade of those trees where they're looking for weevils, looking for worms, and depositing all their manure at the same time. So sun hemp is kind of our backup plan for our pig grazing. We'll try to have enough millet and sorghum and buckwheat available after the sweet potato crop. And if we fail at any time, then we have, you know, acres and acres of the sun hemp that would be a decent forage for him. You can only do it till the sun hemp's about like 20 something inches tall. Once it gets over waist tall, it gets too tough for him, and there's too much of some kind of acid, I think, in the leaves or something. And I know the lignin content is probably really high too, but they just won't eat it after it gets too tall. So just when it's really young, it would be like a backup forage.
What are some of the things you have to take into account when you are planning cover crops for grazing?
While we're grazing, we consider these aspects. So will the animals eat the cover crop or eat the residue of the crop? Like, you know, potatoes. We grow a lot of potatoes, but nothing eats them. So that's kind of a hard one to have graze. So a lot of times you're just disking in any Irish potatoes that are left in the field. The pigs won't eat them. Chickens won't eat them. And, you know, it's not like a sweet potato. And also, you know, the cover crops, if it's like too late in its cycle, like the sun hemp, then yeah, animals won't eat it either. So you just need to know, is it going to be worth it to move your animals over there? Is it going to be good for the land too? It might be detrimental in some ways. Other thing to think about is how much it costs to establish. You know, if cover crops are really expensive to plant, like some years, sun hemp is really expensive to buy the seed. So it wouldn't be like a good primary forage. That's why I say it's our backup forage. It's better for its fertility that it adds as it gets really large, but it's not so beneficial when you graze it down when it's 20 inches tall. So it might be a pretty expensive way to make the forage versus like really cheap millet seed or even buckwheat's pretty reasonable to establish, especially like mixed in with the millet. And you also have to think, this is probably most important, is does the crop fit in with the rotation? So I'll talk a little bit more about the rotation too, but we grow a lot of legume cash crops already. So if we're looking how to have a high protein legume for grazing, it's just not really a good mix with our cash crops. So if you're not doing any cash crops, then you might actually find it's better use of your money to buy some legume seeds that really make a lot more nitrogen per unit of land. For us, we really need 3 years without any beans or peas or any other kind of legumes really in the same block of land so that we're not building up white rot or building up virus or any other kind of diseases that can really get going on legumes. And so for us too, we have found like the sun hemp, for some reason, if it's a distant enough relative of the other legumes, it does not seem to have so much of an issue with the white rot. It doesn't seem to harbor it, and it doesn't seem to hinder any of the other legume crops. So we kind of treat sun hemp as a different family, even though it's a legume, just to see how our rotation works. And then if it's not going from the sweet potatoes into the winter vegetables, then it's coming out of the spring vegetables and going into a summer cover crop. And so this is the other dominant pattern in what we do. And so we'll seed a summer cover crop, buckwheat and millet, mostly buckwheat. And then later on, the millet started coming up. But that's why we do the two species mix. You never know which one's going to work better. Sometimes three species if you can afford it or if the seeds are available. And then after the pigs, we planted coal crops, baby cabbages, a bunch of kale and other stuff in there too. And by early March, that's when the baby cabbages were ready. So go backwards, we had basically spring vegetables, summer cover crop. Then we did a late August, September grazing, and then we planted the cabbages in early November. And then by March, cabbages were ready. It definitely was a longer crop. I think it was even maybe late February. I have to check the dates on there, but we had 120 days from the time that we grazed to the time that we harvested there.
Was there anything about crop livestock integration that you weren't expecting or something that has surprised you?
Part of our livestock program has had to be reproduction. We didn't actually know we had to get into that, I guess, in the beginning. There was always a lot of people that had piglets and it was available to buy piglets. But then as you are in business for more years, you realize that sometimes the piglets aren't there when you need them to be there in your cycle. And plus what we found too is once you start selecting for the pigs that do well at your area, then they stay pretty healthy and they stay pretty productive. We've worked with a breed that's called the Red Wattle, and that's very important. And part of that breed is to know what the genetics are. And we bring a different sire in from a different line to live on site. And we have a few sows that rotate through the honeymoon suite. Where they go eventually is to the farrowing pen. And farrowing is really important. You know, you want a good cover crop there. You want a good spot in the farm. And we plan our farrowing around these, basically give the give the sow the best of what there is at that moment of the year, give her plenty of shade. And then the best thing is that the piglets, as soon as they're born, probably about 7 to 14 days later, depending on their progress, they're already nibbling on the grass. And then, you know, within 3 weeks, you're usually starting to see, you know, that they're eating a decent amount of it. And it starts them off so much quicker, getting them used to their environment, which is, hey, you're here to eat grass, not to eat grain. We don't want pigs that eat too much grain. We really want pigs that can take grass and sweet potatoes and turn them into a healthy body. And that's what we're asking them to eat, what's here, and not always be waiting for the grain. Certain animals will inevitably just be pretty much addicted to grain. They won't go forage for themselves. They'll just wait until the grain comes, and then they get really nasty to have to battle out their siblings or their bunkmates for that grain. And in our system, we're really looking for the opposite. We're looking for pigs that just want to go plow up any part of their block, go find their own sweet potatoes. And there's really no way that a bully pig can dominate that system. And they've all got plenty to eat. They're all, stress-free. And then by the time they get to the end of that block, when they can't find any more sweet potatoes, there's a brand new block right next to them. So every 5 to 7 days, you're just moving them forward.
What types of infrastructure on your farm have you changed or adapted? Or is there infrastructure that you wish you had that would make this type of production system more efficient?
You know, what you really need to master here is electric fencing. And as simple as it seems, it actually requires some training in all your handlers of, you know, electrical theory and even thermodynamics, because a lot of folks don't understand how electric travels or how it's conducted, even how the system works. So you really just need to go over the general way that electric flows. If you know the basic principles of electricity, then you can troubleshoot the issues a lot faster. That's why you need to know it, because you can't have your fences down for too long, or else your animals will get really interested in whatever else is right next to them. You need to have, you know, mastery in it, and that you can put it back up if tree branch blows down. We've had the boars a few times just push down the fence with a bunch of sweet potatoes vines at the same time, or even just almost in coordination. Sometimes they'll do that too. So being able to get it right back up and running is super important. And anybody who's in charge at the farm, not just the farmer, but, you know, anybody who's helping with the animals, they need to know how to troubleshoot it too. And then daily verification of the system is super important. Whatever you do, make sure there's somebody in charge of checking that system at a very minimum once per day, but we check it twice a day in the morning and we check it in the afternoon, making sure that those hotlines are hot and that it's going to be doing its job out there. And then, you know, obviously you have to keep on replacing the line. I think that's an expense to think about. The line lasts maybe two and a half years, I think, before you have to really start replacing it. So once you get a certain amount of it, just plan on always adding some more stock and taking out the old stuff every few months and keep rotating it, and not having to do too much of an investment at any given time. For crop production, you know, it's a whole different discussion for the livestock. We haven't bought too many things other than like a trailer that we'll probably be investing in here in the near future, another trailer for the pig hauling. But on the crop production end of it, we actually got a part grant with the Water Management District to help us buy a fertilizer distributor, but it was way better than we used to do. We used to have to broadcast it out with like a cone spreader. And we do this in small amounts or even, you know, medium-sized amounts for depending on what we're planting. But this is our augmentation of our animal fertility that we put down already. So we've always been using, since I think the first year, some kind of heat-treated chicken manure, pellets or granules to produce our crops. And so with our animals, we've been able to reduce that amount. And some crops will maintain the same amount, but we get so much more fertility out of our animals too. So we're finally starting to see some really good size for like the celeries and certain nitrogen hogs that we were never able to really provide enough nitrogen in our first few years. But now over, you know, the last half a decade or even up to 12 years is one of our oldest blocks. The soil is getting really rich. So it's got a decent amount of nitrogen in there and can grow a decent sized crop. We're still not in massive crops, but we're right where we like to see a good amount of nutrients at the same time as like we're getting a decent amount of volume or whatnot in there for people who want one piece of lettuce to be one piece of lettuce. For 10 years we still do from time to time, but we'll sell two pieces of lettuce as one piece of lettuce in the sales department because they're just so small, and that's fine for the business model if you make it like that. But the other thing we used in terms of helping out with the animal integration is definitely a big disc. We went for like a decade with a 6-foot disc, and we went to an 8-foot disc. It was just incredibly more efficient. We're probably doing half the amount of trips across the field right now with the 8-foot disc. Not always that dramatic, but in a lot of blocks, it is. It used to take us forever to cut up like sun hemp with the 6-foot disc. And now within, I think, 3 passes or so, we're pretty much into the realm where we can rototill and keep the soil moving along.
Can you talk about how you manage food safety on the farm? What are the main issues that you deal with?
This is really the meat of, I think, what people want to know is how do you have vegetables and raise animals at the same time? And this is a really important part of what to talk about, because I think this is where the farm could go really wrong if you didn't acknowledge your risks. But the risks are simple. You don't want to get manure into the product in any way possible. Like you have to look at how does your manure transfer from your paddock to your packing shed or from your paddock to your plantings. We've identified a few different critical control points in our HACCP plan. And our HACCP plan is really simple, but identify the critical control points and then figure out how you're going to validate that they all get met. You know, a big part of what you do is you engineer your field so that not only can the irrigation and the, you know, soil moisture work, but at the same time, you have to think about where the manure runs after leaving a paddock. And so how we lay out all of our plantings is we always keep primarily our vegetables and everything else above in terms of altitude of the manure paddocks. But when that's not possible, there's always going to be an isolation ditch to ensure that no water runs from like a adjacent piece of ground. So all of our vegetable blocks are isolated from any kind of manure that would be coming from any other part of the property. And that's what's really important in your irrigation and drainage plan for your location. So I'd say start there as a farmer. So you're going to need to look at, you know, which way does every drop flow as it comes down out of the sky hits your farm. Then you need to know where your paddocks are and where you're going to raise your crops and what kind of crops you have too. Because you might be able to raise all low risk crops and that'd be fine. But like I said, our crop category is greens. And so we're really important. It's by far the biggest set of crops that we do. And almost all those greens get our parasitic acid. And so that's one of the other points. But before we get to that one, food safety training is right after the water movement. So not only do you need to know which way the water runs on your property, you also need to know that everybody who's working for you has been trained on food safety protocol. And that really involves, you know, safe handling and visiting the animal areas. So making sure the manure is off your boots, make sure you wash your hands, make sure there's no way that you can bring the contaminants back to the packing shed from any manure areas. And so that even includes us using separate equipment for eggs and pigs and vegetables and produce. So we'll try to maintain different equipment loops to not commingle the equipment. When in doubt, or when you know you have a risk, use parasitic acid sanitizer. That's the best organic sanitizer we can find that doesn't have any kind of residue. You know, we use that for services, equipment, and most importantly, wash water. So any of the greens need to go through that wash water with PAA in it. That's really how you manage your risk. You know, multifaceted approach there is you need to make sure that nothing contaminates your plantings out there. You need to make sure that your crew is well trained, and you need to make sure you're using an approved sanitizer, you know, at whatever the labeled rate for your use is. And I think those are the three main CCPs that we've identified. That's how we train. And we're always trying to make that better too. So our food safety training is a living document. And anytime there's an update, we just add it there. And the next time that we do a training, that update's in there. And it's basically as soon as you have an accident somehow, that's when the training gets updated. You're like, how did that accident happen? Oh, all right, let's put that in the manual. So the manual gets just longer and longer as you have more experience. Like, all right, well, we did this once. That didn't end up well. So now we got a policy about it. So that's what you need to do for your own farm, is it's going to be adapted to your own system, your own process, and you need to be in charge of your own training there. Make sure it gets done. For USDA organic compliance, we do ensure that all the crops are being harvested over 120 days from the last grazing date. So mark that grazing date on the calendar, or it can be available in an audit for any of the auditors. And we make sure that we're not harvesting before 120 days from that grazing date. And then we do have a variance on that for crops that don't make contact with the soil, like sweet corn and citrus, things that are arguably you're never going to eat the outside of. They will allow us to have 90 days.
Why is plant or crop rotation important on your farm?
The primary goal of the organic farm, you know, regenerative agriculture, other than the animal rotation, is to rotate your crop successfully, and it's to avoid issues with diseases and pests and nutrient deficiencies that also cause the diseases and pests. So, you know, we're looking at things primarily by family. But even now, as we're 12 years into this, we're realizing that there's different funguses. Sclerotinia, that's the fungus that we really have a problem with. That's there's a white mold or a white rot. That one jumps across the different families. So up until a few years ago, I could have said, oh, it's almost entirely based on plant family. Now we're finding that's true about 80% of the time, 90% of the time, but then you get to some of these pathogens like sclerotinia. So now we're having a link through our planting records. We're able to see this, but actually it gets on to not only sunflowers and lettuces like we've known, it gets on green beans really bad, same one. And it gets on to eggplants and peppers too. So we're seeing the sclerotinia move around different families. And now we're having to adjust our planting rotation based on that. Animals are one of the solutions to this, is when we have a bad problem and we've got maybe too many years in one family or another, or see a bad pest problem, then even historically poor fertility areas, and there are some areas that are just always been kind of poor in either nitrogen or some other element, they're not coming together there of nutrients. So we'll put the pigs in there, we'll put the chickens in there, and we'll graze it instead of one time a year, maybe we'll graze it two or three times a year, and we'll just keep on cover cropping it. And then lo and behold, over a few seasons doing that, it gets almost as good as normal. You know, it's not really ever exceptional, but it definitely improves those fertility spots significantly. It adds that carbon to the soil it really needs usually. So it's just getting more carbon into the soil from the manure and from the bedding and things like that we use around the animals. That's definitely part of it. And part of our nutrient management is that carbon. So think of animals should be increasing the carbon in your soil. If you're doing something with your animals where it's reducing the amount of carbon or soluble organic matter, then you probably need to change your practices. And so far, every block that we've really sampled over a few years, there's been very few exceptions where they have not either maintained the organic matter or actually gotten a lot more organic matter over the last few years. So I think there's only been one or two examples, I think, from the time that we started a ground when they maybe had 2.5% organic matter, but right out of the pasture. And then it went down to maybe like 1.7, but within like 4 or 5 years, it was back up in the 2.5 and even hit like maybe 2.8. So we need more of those samples to get more data, but at least what we've been able to see with the recent UF trials and previous UF trials, when they come out and test the blocks, we're able to see pretty good correlations with what we're doing in the soil organic material. So that's a big part of what we do, is try to keep the, not just the soil organic material, but all the nutrients in the soil, either cycling or maintaining or even increasing if it's something that we can increase, like potassium or something like that.
Can you share some insights about record keeping and how you approach keeping good records and the importance of that in your farming system?
So as we started this system, you know, 2011 at this farm, we already had some background on how to get it up and running. We were able to start with a certain amount of record keeping and getting into it, but we didn't really know how much the records were going to make a difference in the end. And it really comes down to keeping good records and having people keep good records that are working with you. It's not just the farmer, but we actually share our record keeping responsibilities with everybody at the farm, because everybody needs to write their own log and to be accountable for what they do. So we have a itemized way to break down your day, whether you're harvesting or working in the packing shed or driving or any of the tasks at the farm are all in a daily log. And we all need to make our entries. And I try to set a good example. Obviously, we all are not perfect at getting it in. It's actually been one of the most difficult things to work with. The challenges of getting our record keeping in, for all the applicants that have come to this farm, I would say way over half of the applicants struggle with getting data completed by the end of the day. I don't know what it is. It might be just like a homework thing or something that we've all struggled with in the past, but I feel like we're asking for homework when it's actually just paid part of the day. And it's really important. The better data we have, the better we can predict what we need to do next, the better we can calculate what we have in the box, especially like when you're talking about how much does that product cost you right now? That's the goal that we're trying to get to a rapid recall point, is, you know, for one day for the farm to know exactly what's in the box at any given time. Right now, we have a pretty darn good idea about it. We do a lot of calculations, a lot of auditing of the records to see how much every step of it costs. But at the end of the day, we don't know what this week's crop cost until we pull the reports and do the data. And that takes a little bit of time. So to make that all work, you got to have good data. And as part of being the farmer and the data keeper, you're going to have to make sure that the data that comes in is usable data and is good data. And you'll learn as soon as you have one or two people working with you, then you really can't take on their data too. It gets to be overwhelming to know how did they spend their day? Like, what did you all produce? As soon as they're working on their own, then that becomes their prerogative, you know, and I think that's where we need to assign it to our coworkers. It's like, all right, you put in what you did, I put in what I did, And then the way we've made it is that we all have access to that information. So it's all transparent and we can see how the week is spent at the farm. What are we harvesting? What are we planting? Any year we need to go back on, we can go back and say, okay, what did we do last April at this time of the year? You know, what were we harvesting? What were we planting? What were the planting rates when we need to know, you know, our costs for the season? What were our areas that we planted to know when we get recalled for like our organic inspection, or more importantly, like when we need to know what was grown there in our rotations? So all that stuff is so important. And you'd be surprised how much at the beginning, you don't know the questions that you're going to have to ask, and you don't know all the records that you're going to have to keep. And I think that was our surprise too, is that like our original records were sometimes too vague to be really useful. So just do the best you can in laying out what you're going to need. But at the same time, if you make it too specific, you'll never get done with it. So you have to, there's a fine balance of being too specific in your record keeping and not specific enough. So if you know what you're looking for to begin with, like say the value of your crop, then you can tailor your records a little bit better. What's really challenging for, I think, for what we do in terms of diverse vegetable production is to map out your fields in a way that really interact with your records well, because that's where you get into the fine details. And as a small grower, you're going to be planting a lot of different stuff in a small amount of area. And really the best thing I could recommend is having those plot maps match up with really good block numbers that are your block numbers, your block IDs are going to be the size of your plantings. So if it has to get down to the bed, that might be the way you block ID it, so that you can keep track of what was grown in that bed, what was grown in that two beds or maybe three beds together, and group your soil in a way that overlaps with your record keeping in a map that details it for anybody to see, so everybody can be on the same page. Once you have those things kind of congruent, then you can really see your rotations a lot easier and find out, you know, the planning. It really helps with the planning of knowing what you're going to do next in every block. As much as people want to plan ahead of the season, I believe in making a system that's really agile and able to change, because farming never ends up the way that you thought it would. As much as you want to plan for a whole, you know, month before you go into the ground, maybe it works like that up north. But in Florida, it never ends until it does. That's what we say. It never ends until it does. That means that, you know, we might be going for years until we have to take a break. But we need to keep it rolling with different, you know, plantings, different rhythms of what we do. So when a hurricane shuts down some plantings, or when a cold front comes and changes your plans, you need to be able to adapt very quickly and knowing, all right, well, I was going to plant my last planting of squash there, but it got too wet in the ground because it stormed for 3 months. And then I couldn't get the squash in. So now it's too late. What am I going to plant next? Because I got to plant something in that ground. And with a record keeping system that's, you know, easy to recall, you can go to that block and you can see the last 3 years of your records and figure out, all right, well, it's time to plant brassicas. Or no, I had brassicas there 2 years ago, so I can't plant brassicas for at least another year or two. So you got to figure out, you know, oh, I just got the onion seedlings in. How about onions? You look back at your records, good, we're doing onions there. You know, for a block that you set out that month, plant, you know, thinking you're going to plant late planting a squash, you end up planting onions because that was what time it was when you finally got there. And as much as you want to predict that, you know, late October, early November is going to be how you planned it, it never is. It's never the way you thought it was in August, or when you were ordering those onion seeds. You probably had a whole different block set out for those onions to go in, and you're already delayed in that planting for some other reason. So that's just the way that I would say my experience in farming has always been, is just be ready to adapt. And it's good to plan, because, you know, you get some practice in thinking where things are going to go. You know, we plan on spreadsheets, web-based spreadsheets, and then we update those spreadsheets as the plan matures. And that's a good way to look at it. You know, you start with a plan and then it matures. And by the time you get there, it's matured. Then you're on to the next plan. Keep it rolling.
Will you talk about the considerations for caring for animals in the winter, as well as how you determine when to rotate and move your animals throughout the paddocks, and any other animal infrastructure advice that you have?
In terms of animals in the wet season, whatever your wet season is at your farm, you should probably budget your driest land for your animals in that season, because no matter what, you know, it helps you avoid disease. And I said general malaise, because that's what you can, honestly, it's sad. You don't want to see that in your herd. So if you ever see that, you need to like move them, change something. If they're not happy, then they need to be happy. That's your primary job as a livestock producer. And so in your crop rotation and everything like that, you need to actually focus in some of your wet season season time, instead of growing your cash crops all in your dry ground, that dry ground actually needs to be budgeted to animals. Like, not all of it. You're going to have some cash crops, but some of your dry ground needs to be your animal ground too. That's something to think about at the beginning of your rotation. You need to learn to read your animals and when they're done eating, when they're stressed. So that's how you ultimately know when to move your animals. But we find that both in the chickens and the pigs, it helps to set them up in kind of long rectangles, like a lengthwise rectangle. And then you will divide it up into different movements that they'll have smaller paddocks with a divider, usually just a hot wire, or in the chickens, it would just be another piece of fence. It'll keep them in smaller paddocks and you'll move them forward every 5 to 7 days approximately. And that's just based on when they get done with that paddock. That paddock might be like an eighth of an acre. It might be a tenth of an acre, might be a 12th of an acre, you know, somewhere in that range we're probably talking about for most paddocks. And then on the stocking density, we'll typically stock between a half a dozen to a dozen pigs on that stocking density. Might be more on like the, you know, fifth of an acre to quarter acre if you have up to 12 pigs in there, but we'll shrink it down to probably an eighth of an acre or less for, you know, 5 to 6, 7 pigs in there. With the chickens, we're probably close to a quarter acre for like 150 birds or so in there, or maybe a little bit more. And that's not that often. So usually it's probably more around like a tenth of an acre, an eighth of an acre for about, I'd say 60 to 100 birds, somewhere in that range, egg-laying birds. So that's our stocking density in general. And then it varies, but you're basically just seeing when are they done eating and are they stressed. Chickens will show stress by pecking. Pigs will show stress by how they look at you and the body condition or body mass index and, you know, how they conduct themselves. So it's just important to learn those different cues and different communication that their animals are giving you and how to train that too on the folks who are really doing the primary daily tasks for the animals. We use chicken tractors, and it's just a trailer, pretty typical of what folks are going to do the first time, you know, egg boxes on the outside, trailer hitch. We really have tried to get away from a lot of the trailer units because I hate to have wheels out there. And that's a typical thing in our soil, is just we have a lot of clay and a lot of mud that gets into the tire seals and just, you know, ruins the seals on the tires. They go flat. And then you're always trying to fix tires out there. And it's not a good long-term solution. So we've gone to this kind of solution for like the shade structures and even the new chicken coops, where we just lift them up with a tractor. We'll come in there with a front-end loader and we'll just pick it up and move it, you know, to the next paddock over. So really simple designs, you know, just putting a little house on trailer for the chicken coops. But most importantly, it's have the nest boxes on the outside. I think that's one of the important things. And with the pigs, you just want something simple. They just want shade out there. And for farrowing, we just use a hay roll and some shade. So just like a hay bale for them to nest in and everything seems to work. The single hay bale is the best for farrowing.
What remains your biggest challenge on the farm with the crops and the livestock?
Our largest challenges with the livestock has got to be scaling. It's really something that we don't want to go too big at one time. We don't want to go too big too quickly. And it's been like that from the very beginning. In fact, I think we grew really slow in the livestock when we were able to grow a lot of crops a lot faster, like to increase the volume. The livestock is still like a pretty, you know, modest part of what we do through the year. So scaling's got to match the fertility. It's got to match the planting. It's got to match the marketing. If you don't have all those kind of lined up and you have one way out of whack, then the business might fail if you can't get it balanced back out again. Regenerative agriculture and how we do it is livestock, it's got to be a balanced part of your whole system rather than being your only focus, because sometimes it might not work or sometimes it doesn't produce what you think it's going to produce, you know, just like any crop. So we find our security in the diversity of what we do rather than, you know, trying to invest too much into one idea. Because with regenerative agriculture in Florida, it's just always changing. It's like anywhere. It's not always easy to be successful. This year alone, we've seen a decent amount of setbacks just based on the weather and unforeseen events. So with livestock, just only risk what you're able to risk. And also at the same time, keeping the livestock as the number one priority at the farm every day. So if you can't do that, then you probably shouldn't be in the livestock business. But as you're looking at your time and your usage of time and your priorities, you've got to prioritize your livestock needs over everything. You have to be able to budget that into your system. And that's where I think you can see that scaling that system is going to be equally as challenging, because the whole system has to scale, not just the livestock piece. The other large challenge is it's got to be the education of the consumer. And then also that has to do with the imported organic produce that we have to compete with. And it's just, until that changes, we're going to always struggle to make the sale price for what we need to pay Americans what they need at the same time, a living wage. The counterfeit produce is just always, it's always there. And unless people have that education and values, it's not just education. I feel like a lot of people have the education, but then they lack the values because they know it, but they just don't do anything about it. And that's probably the hardest thing right there is living in that culture of knowing, but not doing anything about it. And I think we're getting to the point where most people have at least heard this at one time, that their food is contaminated and they need to eat non-contaminated food. So I think the rest of it's just people ignoring their values at a certain point and not paying their neighbors to grow their food. You know, it costs so much more pound per pound to produce these high quality crops, but there's actually like a really huge value in those crops because the nutrients are so dense. And so if we could quantify that somehow, educated people could quickly compare, you know, our carrots to a grocery store carrot and be like, oh, well, yeah, Frog Song carrots are like 1/10 of the price of the grocery store carrots. If you're going to go, you know, beta carotene or any of those qualifiers of like what's in the carrot. Ours would just blow it out of the water because of how the crops are grown. It all has to do with how the animals walked across the land, how we treated the land throughout that whole time, and then how we planted the crops. And when the crops are planted with all natural fertility, then the nutrients that are in them are so much richer. I mean, there's so many more nutrients per volume, per mass, whatever you want to measure it in. We will be so much larger, you know, than the grocery store average. So that's where I think if we could convey that to the customers in a really rapid way, maybe like a cell phone app that eventually reads through your camera or other sensors there, you know, then the customers can make the easy choice. They're like, all right, actually, farmer's market is way cheaper than going to the grocery store and paying almost the same amount in money, but getting a fraction of the nutrients. And you're getting a lot more contamination too when you go to the grocery store. So that's the other thing that would be great for people to really know what's on the crops. The largest challenge, at least in my lifetime here, will probably be keeping the farm staffed. It's just super hard to find capable people. And I think that really goes back into the education system, because as farmers, our work has just been so devalued. So for here, if you're dealing with an education system that has never produced a farmer, really, like if you look at the last 50 years of our education system, almost everybody that's gone through it has learned to not be a farmer because we don't value this work. So now what do we have? We have nobody that can really come out to the farm and produce food at the rate that their neighbors can afford it. So if your best and brightest are coming out and picking 10 bunches of kale per hour, that doesn't really even get you to their wage for where their wage is in terms of the division of that crop expenses. So it's just, it's really hard to explain to folks too, that like what we're working for out here is not just our own salary. Our salary is a small part of the larger thing that we're doing here, because here's all that it takes. Here's, you know, there's so many expenses around every turn here. It's a whole different kind of business model. You know, if they're in any different business model, folks are thinking that productivity has a whole different scale. Like in farming, productivity is really how your whole day is spent, how you handle yourself and how you can accomplish your work. For us, I don't think that that has really been an attribute of most of the applicants that come here. It's like to try to teach productivity seems like something completely foreign to most of our American applicants. In their defense too, it's like, I just think that it's never taught at school because, you know, we have applicants from other countries that have a much better grasp of productivity and like how we work from day to day and what we can get done with our hands. So we try to teach that, and that's where we stay with like trying to stay optimistic with it. We know that folks are coming from an education system that has never taught them productivity or care of the earth or care of the land, you know, how to be productive, but actually regenerating the system at the same time. We're probably, you know, starting the process right now of education. So the best that we can do is just stay positive and keep on teaching people. And but you want to know what our struggles are. This is the one that drives most farmers out of business. This is the reason that most people can't make it, is because the money in for the product doesn't equal the money out for the labor. And those are sometimes too far apart to actually make them meet and have a business model be successful.
For our last question, will you talk a little bit about what is next for you and Frog Song Organics? Where do you see yourselves going?
in terms of our biggest dream here is to be a grain independent, hopefully. I had set my goal at 10 years after starting the farm, but we passed that a few years ago. So I think I have to kind of expand this goal to the 20 to 25 year range, knowing how much work it is. But we'd really like to be able to harvest some of these cover crops when they're in the prime ripeness for grain consumption or for feed consumption. And then for the ones that don't make it, you know, that are slightly mildewy or whatever out in the field, if you don't get it to dry down in the field, that's a problem with grains in Florida, is if you don't hit it at the exact moment, then, you know, it's not going to really work out well for saving the grain. But if you got, you know, a few herds of chickens out there, like 500, 800 chickens, well, by all means, just go put them out there on the grain that maybe got too wet in a rainstorm or so, and they'll go eat it up before it gets actually moldy out in the field. So having the animals still tied in with our production, but being able to capture the unique moments that we'd get a good buckwheat or millet or rye or wheat or oats crop when the weather cooperates. I think that could really take the operation into a different realm of sustainability, because then we could save our seed, we could save feed for rations, and we could most importantly make actual flour out of it for human consumption. To do this, it's going to require not only the combine, which we're looking at these plot size combines, which are kind of research combines. I'll tell you in, you know, another 10 years or so if this actually works, but having a smaller combine that can run between our tree rows, between our different plantings, and having that kind of combine that can run, you know, 5 to 20 acres a day if necessary, and not even that much, really 5 acres a day would be plenty of enough capacity. And then we'd need, you know, aspirators and winnowers at the seed cleaning facility, which is a huge building that we'd have to build. Gravity tables, sorters and graders. I mean, to have the kind of quality grain that we'd want out of our challenging organic conditions. I've seen a lot of different equipment, and it's a huge investment to do this. But I think eventually, with enough data and experience of growing the cover crops, we can get ourselves into this, because we just needed to learn all the challenges of growing them first before you could set a business model out on it. And then, you know, to store everything. Thing. The silos and conveyors are a whole different set of equipment, but that's really where you store for your seed and for your feed. It's a huge amount of equipment, but maybe one day we'll get it all set up, and that'll be the completion of our livestock program, and we really don't have to buy our feed anymore.
Thank you so much, John, for sharing your story with us and all of your experience on the farm with crop livestock integration. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Appreciate you guys. This is cool to get to take part of this, because I've been saying for years that we need to help people integrate more livestock into the vegetable and the fruit, any kind of row crop production.
OFRF would like to thank John Bitter and Frog Song Organics for sharing their story. This interview was created with funding from Organic Valley's Farmers Advocating for Organics program. We thank them and other funders for their ongoing support. Be sure to visit our website to explore the other resources on integrated crop livestock systems at ofrf.org/crop-livestock-integration. And thank you for listening.